You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Fighting for the Soul of France. Pitched battles, political, cultural, and racial, are roiling the heart of La République by Tom Sancton, with opening illustration by Matt Chase, showing Napoleon Bonaparte riding his horse in a boat on a stormy ocean, a la that famous Asian illustration. Napoleon Bonaparte is arguably the most famous Frenchman who ever lived. But this year, as the country commemorates the bicentennial of his death, a fierce controversy is raging over the emperor's legacy. Despite his glories, detractors point to the darker side of the ledger. Napoleon destroyed the republic founded in the aftermath of the French Revolution, led hundreds of thousands of soldiers to die in a futile invasion of Russia, imposed a civil code that put women under male domination, and, most egregiously, re-established slavery in French colonies, including the island of Saint-Domingue, now Haiti, in 1802, 9 years after the Revolutionary Convention had abolished it. A decision that French President Emmanuel Macron recently called a mistake, a betrayal of the spirit of enlightenment. In the words of Françoise Vergès, a political scientist and militant feminist, Napoleon was a racist, sexist, despot, militarist, and colonizer, but all of that is generally swept under the rug. Not anymore. The debate over Napoleon's merits and demerits goes far deeper than the assessment of a long-dead ruler. It is part of a fundamental re-examination of France's history, culture, and society. On the one hand, there are the traditionalists who defend France's universal values of republicanism, egalitarianism, secularism, and national unity. On the other, an increasingly vocal faction, derided as avatars of what they call American-style wokeisme, focuses on issues steeped in identity politics, post-colonialism, anti-racism, and feminism. And beyond that debate, the country is undergoing profound political, economic, and demographic changes that portend a very different France emerging from the COVID-19 pandemic. On the political front, France is losing faith in its traditional parties and leaders. Former President Nicolas Sarkozy was recently convicted in a corruption scheme and handed a 3-year jail sentence, 2 years of which were suspended. He went on trial in May for alleged improper campaign financing during his unsuccessful 2012 attempt at re-election. His former prime minister, François Fillon, was convicted of paying his wife more than €1 million out of public funds for a fictitious job. Both cases are under appeal. And these are just the more prominent examples of French politicians running afoul of the law. Some analysts blame the wave of guilty verdicts on activism by left-leaning judges. But the main effect is to feed into a populist rejection of the whole political class as tout pourri, all rotten. Though Macron and his government have so far avoided becoming ensnared in such scandals, the president's standing has been weakened by this populist distrust. Witness the massive yellow vest movement that began in 2018. Macron rode to power as a fresh-faced reformer, denouncing politics as usual. But many of his policies, especially his proposed pension reform, have sparked resistance, while his ad hoc movement, Republic on the March, has suffered numerous defections prompted by his often brittle authoritarian style. His disapproval rating, per the French Institute of Public Opinion, stands at 62%, though harsh criticism of sitting presidents is something of a French custom. Looking forward to the 2022 presidential election, none of the traditional parties has so far come up with compelling candidates, meaning Macron will likely face Marine Le Pen, leader of the far-right anti-immigration National Rally Party, in the runoff. In 2017, Macron easily prevailed over Le Pen in the second round. This time, though, some voters, especially on the left, may abstain rather than support Macron again. That is sobering news for the incumbent and for the future of France. When the traditional right and left seem exhausted, says Pascal Perrineau, a political science professor at Sciences Po, people turn to the populist elsewhere for a sense of renewal or just a desire to flip the table over. In the current climate, Le Pen has a plausible shot at winning. Her chances are helped by the government's mismanagement of the pandemic, which has racked France with its biggest national crisis since World War II. From the beginning, the Macron administration sent mixed messages, then bungled the vaccine rollout amid ineffectual off and on lockdowns, widespread unemployment, and a severe recession, all of which will weigh on the next election. When we do come out of the COVID crisis, warns Perrineau, the public's cold anger can turn hot. That's the moment when the French will take stock and call the government to account. Even as Le Pen benefits from Macron's miasma, she is gaining support as a champion of Republican values in the face of what many see as an overreaching social justice movement. That is quite a turnaround. Until now, the party founded by her father, the truculent ex-paratrooper Jean-Marie Le Pen, has been ostracized by the mainline parties precisely because its program was considered racist, anti-Semitic, and borderline fascist. Now, as part of an extraordinary makeover aimed at normalizing her image, Le Pen is posing as the defender of universalism, secularism, integration, and women's rights against what she calls the ideologies of division, of hatred, of violent demands, which I consider profoundly anti-French. The true French values, she tells me in a Zoom interview, are assimilation, unity of the Republic, and the fact that no right can be given or denied to someone because of their religion, skin color, origin, or sexual orientation. In the past, it was the left that upheld those principles most fervently. Today, the left is bitterly divided between old-school traditionalists, with their focus on class struggle and economic justice, and the newer, younger currents that insist that the crucial issues are anchored in race, identity, and gender. This intensifying culture war is part of a bleak transformation in the way the French see themselves and their place in the world. The comforting self-image of France as an important power, a fount of Western culture, and a model of Enlightenment values is giving way to a fear of national decline. I am very worried, says Alain Finkielkraut, a philosopher, author, and political commentator with roots in the traditional left. I think we have entered a crisis from which I'm not sure we can recover. France is challenged by uncontrolled immigration and is undergoing a demographic change unprecedented in our history. In the face of this challenge, a large part of the French elite is reacting with a systematic and delirious self-flagellation. And when part of a people loses the desire to remain true to itself, the situation is extremely grave. Finkelkraut's concerns over the impact of immigration are widely shared, and not only among Le Pen's supporters. The germ of the controversy goes back to the 1950s and 60s, when French industry encouraged the influx of North African guest workers, mostly from nations that France had colonized, as a source of cheap labor during the post-war rebuilding effort. Their presence was supposedly temporary, but many of them stayed, raised families, and brought relatives from their home countries, settling in ever-growing housing projects. They were joined by later generations, many from sub-Saharan Africa, with the result that in 2019, immigrants made up some 10% of the French population. In 2017, nearly 9% of the country's inhabitants were Muslim. According to so-called universalist theory, the newcomers were supposed to assimilate, embrace French culture, and become ordinary French citizens. But ordinary to whom? France never invested in integration policies, says François Jamin, a Belgian specialist on migration who lectures at Sciences Po. This has caused resentment from minorities who say they are discriminated against, that there is no investment in their neighborhoods. They want to be heard and claim more visibility. That doesn't go down well with much of the Republic, who don't like the idea of minorities becoming visible. They don't want to be a U.S. or U.K.-style multicultural country. Multiculturalism is considered a bad word, but there is a discrepancy between principles and reality. France is, in fact, multicultural. Next photos, French President Emmanuel Macron and his potential rival in the next election, Marine Le Pen. Irrespective of immigration issues, Islamist radicalism has struck France hard. In the past year, the country has suffered 4 serious attacks by terrorists, including one grisly incident in which a middle school teacher was beheaded by a man of Chechen descent for having shown caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad as part of a classroom discussion on free speech. In response, Macron proposed a so-called anti-separatism law aimed at upholding secularism and combating such extremism. The measure, wending its way through Parliament, targets online hate speech, bolsters government oversight of religious associations, and reinforces the requirement of religious neutrality in the public sphere. Though the text never mentions Islam specifically, some leftist critics complain that it discriminates against all Muslims, while some on the right say it doesn't go far enough. With an eye to a probable second-round duel against Le Pen, the Macronist forces are adopting an increasingly hard line on immigration, radicalism, and even dress codes. We're seeing a rightward shift being carried out on the back of Islam in the name of secularism and the Republic, says Michel Wiborka, a prominent sociologist. I think this move to the right is a French way of resisting cultural change. Meanwhile, another incident set off alarms over new left excesses in the universities. In March, Melanie Luce, a 24-year-old law student and president of the left-leaning National Union of French Students, revealed that the organization sponsored non-mixed meetings reserved for non-whites. That triggered critics, who saw the exclusion of whites as a form of inverted racism. Comparing the practice to fascism, Education Minister Jean-Michel Blanquer vowed to take legislative action to ban such meetings. In her cramped office in Paris, Luce tells me that the nature of the meetings has been totally misunderstood. They're just twice-a-year discussion groups, she says, on sexism, racism, homophobia, transphobia, and Islamophobia. The aim is for people who experience discrimination to be able to express what they go through in a setting that allows them to speak freely. Luce, who is biracial herself, her mother is a black woman from Guadeloupe, her father, a white Jewish man from Paris, contends, "What my generation wants is true equality, where a person who looks like me doesn't have less of a chance to succeed than a white person, where we don't have to hide when the police come. The political class has trouble understanding this aspiration." The evolution of French thinking on race has been transformative. Under France's universalist doctrines, all citizens are equal and undifferentiated, to the point where the government keeps no official statistics on the ethnicity of its own population. What's happening today, however, is that race, once considered by many to be a non-issue, has become paramount in the eyes of this new left, along with gender, LGBTQ+ rights, and the combination of discriminations that fall under the overarching heading of intersectionality. Proponents insist that the notion of race has been ignored by an establishment that has failed to come to terms with France's history as a colonial and slave trading power. True equality can only be achieved, they say, by examining and deconstructing that legacy. That is the meaning of the decolonial movement championed by researchers like Nasir Gueneh Suleyma, a sociologist at the University of Paris 8. The question is to know how to move away from the colonial nature of power, she recently told Lapointe. This colonial order has not disappeared with the end of colonial empires, but is reconfigured and continues to act. Post-colonial thought, she says, seeks to dismantle the persistence of social and political hierarchies founded on the racial categorization of humans. Many critics see these new movements as imports from U.S. campuses where black studies, women's studies, and gender studies have long had their own departments. French resistance to such categories is not just a matter of knee-jerk anti-Americanism. It reflects a deep-seated belief that U.S.-style communitarianism is fundamentally at odds with the French model of a unitary nation of equal citizens. The Anglo-Saxon tradition has another history, and it is not ours, Macron said, bemoaning the rising influence of certain social science theories imported from the United States of America. Others are more scathing. The left is becoming Americanized, says Finkelkraut, and it's an Americanization much more toxic than the Coca-Cola and blue jeans that the French traditionally denounced. Some say the claims of U.S. contagion are exaggerated. You don't have to be American to raise issues like that, says sociologist Wivorka. People in France began to pose the question of identities in the wake of the May 1968 student uprising. One thing is a constant in France. When you want to disqualify an idea, a way of thinking, or a political current, you say, "Oh, that's American." Indeed, the country of Simone de Beauvoir did not need American feminists to focus attention on gender discrimination. Similarly, much of the groundbreaking work on post-colonial theory was done by French and Francophone thinkers, such as the political philosopher Frantz Fanon. In fact, the current debate on decolonialism has more to do with France's own legacy as a colonial power than with sociological theories coming from across the Atlantic. Yet certain trends do bear the undeniable mark of stateside influence. The U.S.-born hashtag MeToo movement has taken off with a vengeance in France. In recent months, the list of prominent French personalities under fire for alleged acts of rape, sexual harassment, incest, or pedophilia has continued to grow. In spring 2020, the Black Lives Matter protest over the death of George Floyd set off impassioned French marches, complete with English language posters reading, "I can't breathe," and charges of police brutality in the case of Adama Traoré, a young French Malian man who died in police custody in 2016. Like their U.S. counterparts, French social justice activists have blocked campus appearances by ideologically objectionable speakers and forced the Sorbonne to postpone a play by Aeschylus because some of the white actors wore dark masks and makeup. France is slowly following the American road, lamented Le Monde editor Michel Guérin, which leads to galloping self-censorship by artists and programmers seeking to avoid problems. There is nothing new, of course, in the use of the American example by different factions in France. Tocqueville, himself a liberal monarchist, studied American democracy in the 1830s to learn what we should hope or fear from it. In the mid-19th century, it was the French left that exalted the image of American liberty and used it as a propaganda weapon against the authoritarian regime of Napoleon III. With the founding of the Third Republic in 1870, the left's ardor for the American model cooled, and for much of the next century morphed into often virulent anti-Americanism. Today, we are seeing a repeat of earlier patterns, with many French progressives adopting American social theories and modes of political activism while their opponents decry the U.S. influence. It was easier to reject whatever came from the U.S. of A. as long as Donald Trump was in the White House. But the American image as a whole is making a spectacular comeback in France ever since Joe Biden took over and launched his bold stimulus and infrastructure plans. In a sign of what Le Monde has called Biden mania, the new U.S. president drew an 82% approval rating in one recent French poll. That doesn't necessarily translate into an embrace of American-style social justice movements, but it may make it a bit more difficult to demonize them. More than two centuries ago, Napoleon carried his version of French values across most of Europe as the head of his Grande Armée. Today, two revolutions, two world wars, and four republics later, France is a very different nation. President Charles de Gaulle famously extolled a certain idea of France, a grand-sounding phrase most notable for its vagueness. Today, more than ever, the question remains, what idea? Which France? In a diversifying land, the answers are multiple. She, herself, and we. As the other half to WeWork's billionaire founder, Rebecca Newman carved out her own little space as a woo-woo exec, and the company's downfall isn't stopping her, by Rachel Dodes. There's a cringy scene in Hulu's WeWork, or the making and breaking of a $47 billion unicorn, in which Rebecca Newman stands on a stage beside her husband, WeWork's founder, and then CEO, Adam Newman, at a company retreat called Summer Camp. Dressed in a t-shirt and fitted blazer, her long hair hanging limply over her shoulders, she tells the audience of assembled employees to close their eyes and join hands. Her voice is deep and monotone, with a vestigial Long Island accent. Just think about a reality in which the energy that we're feeling right now with one another is an energy of unity, she says, an energy where I am you and you are me, and we all are we. But they were not her, and she was not them, and they were most definitely not we. The Newmans were we, having secured the trademark to the word and later charging the company $5.9 million to license it back. After a public outcry, they returned the money. She was commanding them to do as she said from the well-lit stage, and they were down in the mud, wearing special wristbands to track their mandatory attendance. Many of the employees at the retreat would soon find themselves out of a job, their stock options worthless, following the co-working giant's wild expansion and aborted IPO, while the Newmans would gently drift to earth under a gilded $1.7 billion parachute. When they started going into all these other businesses, I was like, are we doing something to change the world? Or are we doing something to line the Newman's pockets, said a longtime employee, one of the 20 people interviewed for this story, many of whom requested anonymity for fear of legal or professional retribution. Rebecca Newman, through her press representative Asher Gold, declined. What the Newmans have done has inspired a content bonanza. A hit 7-episode podcast series by Wondery, 2 high-profile investigative books, and a take on the story from just about every streaming service. In addition to the Hulu documentary, HBO Max released Generation Hustle, a series about American scammers, with an episode about the Newmans' unusual leadership style entitled The Cult of WeWork. Apple TV Plus started production on We Crashed, based on the Wondery podcast, following the greed-filled rise and inevitable fall of WeWork. and the narcissist whose chaotic love made it all possible, with Academy Award-winning actors Anne Hathaway and Jared Leto playing the couple. Still to come, an adaptation of Wall Street Journal reporters Elliot Brown and Maureen Farrell's book, starring Nicholas Brown, who plays Cousin Greg on Succession via Chernin Entertainment, which has a multi-year first-look deal with Netflix. But the Hulu documentary really hammers home Rebecca's executive dominance at the company, lest you think it was all her husband, and she has now found herself in the company of great American grifters. She's the latest example of a late-stage capitalist archetype, a member of the chugistocracy, banal, rich, white women leveraging their proximity to power to build their own personal brands. Like her friend Ivanka Trump, Rebecca lacks charisma on film and in person, according to people who know her, and gives off weird vibes. Which is ironic, given that she has been known to have people fired, such as a mechanic for WeWork's Gulfstream jet, within minutes of meeting them because she didn't like their energy. I got the sense that she was guiding the company through her astrological intuition, said a person who met with Rebecca for a contract role, during which they mostly discussed his birth sign to determine if he would be a good fit, energetically speaking. He was not. Another person said that both Adam and Rebecca complimented him several times on his good energy when they first met him. He was hired. And then there's the company's legendary S-1 form, required for all businesses seeking to sell shares to the public, complete with a dedication on the first page to the energy of we, greater than any one of us, but inside all of us. New York University marketing professor and author Scott Galloway said in the Hulu documentary that the S-1 read like a novel written by someone who was shrooming. In fact, it was Rebecca, who is widely credited for the unconventional New Age language contained in the document, which also empowered her to select her husband's successor should he become incapacitated. By now, just about everyone knows the origin story of WeWork, the co-working startup founded by two extremely tall men, Adam Neumann, a 6'5" college dropout who grew up on a kibbutz in Israel, and Miguel McKelvey, a 6'8" architect who grew up on a commune in Oregon. Inspired by the paradoxical concept of a capitalist kibbutz, they launched in 2010 with a single location in downtown New York City. Within 9 years, they grew WeWork to approximately 12,500 employees, spread out over 29 countries. With more than 500,000 paying customers, ranging from independent freelancers to huge corporations, all while burning through billions in investors' money. By 2019, when Rebecca started calling herself a co-founder, an interesting pivot, according to a former employee, the company had attained an eye-popping $47 billion valuation and moved beyond renting desk and toward a grandiose vision involving elevating the world's consciousness through, among other ventures, co-living, We Live, Education, We Grow, and Fitness Rise by We. Wow, We. In the photo, the Neumanns in 2009, the year before they founded WeWork. Back in 2017, after naming herself CEO of WeGrow, a school with the lofty mission of unleashing every human's superpowers, Rebecca gave an interview to Fast Company in which she explained her motivations for expanding into education. Her eldest daughter's kindergarten just wasn't the right environment, she said. She wanted a place that would nurture children's spirits and souls as much as their minds, a place where they could learn about meditation and mindfulness, farming and entrepreneurship. Launching a for-profit private school in the hyper-competitive New York City market was highly unusual, particularly for someone with no background in childhood education. Rebecca nevertheless succeeded in convincing wealthy parents to enroll their children in the school, which charged between $22,000 and $42,000 for tuition, depending on age, although many of the families were given discounts, and that had the effect of boosting enrollment at launch. Some experts in New York City private school admissions, whose clients pay thousands of dollars for guidance through the complicated process, said that even with its high-tech pedigree, the We Grow School was too unproven a concept for them to recommend. I advise clients to send their children to schools with an established track record of transitioning students to good colleges, said Max Metz, partner at New York Private School Consultants. Would you put your children in the first spaceship, or would you want to test it out first? To Amanda Ury, founder of Manhattan Private School Advisors, the whole thing seemed like a vanity project, started by a woman who was so privileged she didn't really have to worry about typical concerns, like positioning her kids for acceptance into top universities. Very wealthy parents are often more relaxed about where their kids get into college because they know those same kids will always be financially well off, thanks to them, she said. Indeed, Rebecca has said that she doesn't even know if her own kids will go to college. The school she ultimately created in the WeWork headquarters building in Chelsea, designed by Danish architect Bjarke Ingels and featured in Architectural Digest, would have morning meditation classes called We Practice and offer mentorship and entrepreneurship opportunities. In my book, there's no reason why children in elementary schools can't be launching their own businesses, Rebecca told Bloomberg. Students would spend one day a week at the Newman's Westchester farm cultivating vegetables and then selling their harvest to WeWork employees at farm stands they designed. One former WeWork employee described feeling an awkward sense of pressure to buy the produce during the workday, given that, after all, these were the boss's kids. Rebecca would wax poetic about her techno-utopian vision of the future, in which families could travel around the world unencumbered by the inconvenient school calendar. Never we mind the carbon footprint of such exploration, because soon they would have We Grow Systems, a plug-and-play subscription model education service that would exist everywhere WeWork existed. In 5 years, WeWork will be the new norm for education, Adam prophesied at an event in 2018. It wasn't the norm that year in at least one regard. Only 74.1% of the students at the We Grow School were up to date on all their immunizations, compared to the state average of 96%. According to New York State Department of Health records, from the 2018 to 2019 school year, the most recent for which data are available, almost 4% of We Grow students cited religious exemptions to vaccines that year, compared with 0% at prestigious private schools such as Horace Mann, Trinity, and Collegiate, although not dissimilar to anthroposophic institutions such as Steiner and Waldorf schools that are known for emphasizing children's spiritual development. The We Grow School only had about 46 students that year, four of whom were the Newman's own children. On Lewis Howes' School of Greatness podcast, at the end of 2018, Rebecca admitted she has some phobias around wellness and health, stemming from the death of her older brother from cancer when she was a child. On the same podcast, she tossed out pseudoscientific nonsense, such as the idea that eating sad animals will make you sad because you absorb the energy of what you eat, and that the secret to living forever is having a flexible spine. Rebecca has claimed to be a vegetarian since she was 12. But a person who worked closely with her said that for a period of time, she ate red meat once a week because a doctor told her that her body needed it and said she would close her eyes while doing it. People who worked closely with Rebecca say that, at her best, she is smart and driven and was influential on WeWork's branding, coming up with clever ideas like the slogan, "Do What You Love," focusing on creators and honing the company's environmentally conscious ethos through efforts like banning meat consumption in the office. Parents who sent their children to the WeGrow school said they were impressed by the team she hired, and that until the school closed at the end of the 2020 school year, it was a positive experience. Friends describe her as generous, always willing to offer the keys to one of her homes, a nurturing mother, and extremely spiritual. One friend likened Rebecca to a hungry ghost, a Buddhist metaphor that describes a person tormented by unfulfillment. One person who worked with her said it was difficult to get her to commit to any decision, no matter how small. For example, when Rebecca needed to order chairs for the WeGrow school, she insisted on seeing 30 samples of the same cushion so she could visualize what the setup would look like, as opposed to looking at a computer-generated mock-up, this person said. Rebecca would often ask WeWork construction workers to fix things in her homes. She loathed the appearance of cords and electrical outlets and had an office with no hard surfaces, requiring anybody meeting with her to sit on an oversized pink couch. While visitors awkwardly balanced their laptops on their knees, she would sprawl out on the floor on a fluffy white sheepskin rug. Two former employees recalled that the Newmans employed a minder per child back when they had only four children. As of March, they have six. It was a big and busy life, but as a former employee who worked closely with Adam and Rebecca says, they really believe they were anointed to change the world. Before Rebecca met Adam, she was on a six-year hiatus from dating, focusing on her spiritual journey, first in India, then in Los Angeles, and at the Omega Institute in upstate New York, where she got certified as a yoga instructor. Once she was back in New York City, the two were introduced by Andrew Finkelstein, a friend of Rebecca's from college who was now a Hollywood agent. Adam always liked regaling crowds with the story of how he met his wife. On their first date, she looked me straight in the eye and she said, "You, my friend, are full of shit," he recalled, during a 2017 speech at Baruch College. He was both the star commencement speaker and, finally, a graduate 15 years after enrolling. The retelling of the anecdote in different locations is depicted four times in the Hulu documentary and twice in the HBO Max series, showing how a clever bit was tried, tested, and proven effective with audiences. He also has said that Rebecca has used her years of accumulated wisdom to teach him about the game of life. But, as any player knows, game recognizes game. Rebecca has played many in her 43 years. Wall Street trainee, spiritual seeker, yogi, actor, mother, entrepreneur. She double majored in Buddhism and business at Cornell, where she rushed the Kappa Kappa Gamma sorority, was known to her friends as Rebe, and dated a guy on the crew team who is now married to Jennifer Love Hewitt. Full disclosure, she was 1 year behind me at Cornell, and while we shared acquaintances, we did not know each other. Back then, her name was Rebecca Paltrow, and everybody who knew her on campus also knew she was Gwyneth Paltrow's cousin. Later, as Rebecca Keith, a stage name, she starred alongside Rosario Dawson in Awake, a short film she wrote and produced, wherein a woman in the depths of the American nightmare is forced to become enlightened or die, according to the Internet Movie Database. But her most iconic, fascinating performance to date is playing Rebecca Newman in the Hulu documentary in which she and her husband declined to participate. Born in Great Neck, Long Island, and raised in Bedford, New York, the youngest of four children, Rebecca grew up ensconced in privilege. She always had an appreciation for nature, which she credits to her mother, Evelyn, whose family was in the garment and accessories business, and for hard work, which she attributes to her father, who ran a direct mail business and was later sentenced to prison for tax evasion. He taught me how to live a meaningful life, which I am living today, a combination of having a loving marriage, raising children with high ethical and moral standards, and having a career that hopefully impacts the world in a positive way, Rebecca wrote in a letter appended to her father's sentencing memorandum in 2015. In a 2016 fashion spread for Porter magazine that described the Newmans as the $16 billion beatnik couple revolutionizing the way we live, Rebecca tried to downplay her comfortable upbringing, saying she grew up off a dirt road in like a treehouse. But Paltrow, who was also interviewed, promptly shut her down. They were well off, she said. Rebecca was integral to her husband's business from the start, though her role was mostly as a behind-the-scenes advisor, financier, and muse, what she called a strategic thought partner. At an event in 2018, she raised some eyebrows when she declared that a big part of being a woman is to help men like Adam manifest their calling in life. When the company launched, she was still trying to make it as an actor, according to early employees of WeWork. Her famous cousin loomed large in her mind. She debated about whether to continue using her birth name in the industry and met in WeWork's office with consultants to advise her about the issue, according to employees who were there at the time. She set up a Google alert for news about Paltrow, according to one of these people. Even when she was still trying to break into acting, Rebecca believed so strongly in her husband's vision that she took a big bet. Financing WeWork's first location, using some of the $1 million that her parents had given the couple as a wedding gift. Then, as the company expanded, she dropped acting altogether and got more involved in the business. Once it reached a $1 billion valuation, attaining that vaunted unicorn status, suddenly WeWork was enough for her. It was nothing to be embarrassed about, said a former employee. She took on the role of chief brand and impact officer, pushing aside Julie Rice, an executive who was hired in 2017 with the title of chief brand officer. By then, an internal memo had circulated around the company stating that she would henceforth be known only as Rebecca Newman, not Rebecca Paltrow Newman or RPN. On WeWork's website, her title was updated to founder, CEO, and mom, specifying that she studied under His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Mother Nature herself. As the company's valuation soared, so did the Newman's dreams. Adam said he wanted to build a WeWork on Mars and be president of the world. He wanted to solve the problem of hunger and help orphans find families. We want to create a whole we world where everybody is unified and happy and together, Rebecca said in 2018. Since they were pushed out of the we company at the end of 2019, the Newmans have been downsizing. They've sold at least three of their six homes, a California estate, a Westchester mansion, and a Hamptons farmhouse, for a reported total of $27 million. Their six-bedroom Gramercy Park apartment has been on the market since last year for $37.5 million. They hunkered down in Tel Aviv for a few months in 2020 before returning to the Hamptons village of Amagansett, where they live adjacent to an estate owned by Gwyneth Paltrow and her mother Blythe Danner. As federal and state investigators reportedly examine the Newmans' business dealings, they are living their lives with their six children and support staff while hatching plans for their next ventures. For Adam, it's a new business that involves what happened in the world because of the pandemic, according to the New York Post. He's also been investing in various startups tied to the real estate world. In late April, he was spotted in Miami at an impromptu industry confab called Miami Tech Week at a party held at the Venetian Islands mansion of financier Robert Zangrillo, who was pardoned by Donald Trump for his involvement in the Varsity Blues college admission scandal. "It felt like I was meeting post-crucifixion Jesus," tweeted Dalian Asparov, a principal at Founders Fund, which organized the event. Tech investor Shiel Monat, who was also at the party, said he saw Adam wandering aimlessly around the house, adding that he didn't appear to be with anybody. He seemed pretty out of touch. Rebecca, meanwhile, appears to have a goal of creating another educational project out of the ashes of We Grow, the rights to which she purchased when it closed. The new endeavor is called SOLFL, pronounced Soulful, an acronym that means Student of Life for Life. The Soulful Instagram account now boasts an attractive orange bubble font avatar and 26,000 followers, and contains a link to a website featuring images of a surfer riding a wave, a bounty of fresh figs, and a form where you can be the first to know about what's happening with the project. According to a person familiar with the matter, she has taken over a building in Amagansett to school her kids, along with the children of a few other families, and has been reaching out to former WeWork employees to join the venture. Meanwhile, WeWork is finally having its IPO through a special purpose acquisition company. In order to settle litigation with the founder and go public, last February, the company agreed to give Adam an enhanced stock award worth $245 million. "They don't think they've done anything wrong," said her former friend, who thinks otherwise. "They think everybody loves them."
Thank you.
This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.